It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The world's libraries are moving online, and Google is doing much of the work. The company has scanned 7 million books and counting. The prospect of a virtual super library excites many people and also raises concerns that as books go digital, the act of reading may become less private. NPR's Martin Costi reports.
Novelist Jonathan Lethem says books should be intimate. He thinks back to when he was young, when he was discovering literature.
When I was on this very private, very eccentric, intense journey as a younger person, it was crucial that it be a solitary practice.
Lethem wonders whether future readers will enjoy the same kind of solitude. With digital books, he says, readers will be able to discover new kinds of literature, but they may also be constantly mindful of the fact that their reading choices can be recorded. The Google Books project especially causes him mixed emotions.
Google is trying something extraordinary, and they're to be congratulated and encouraged in every possible way to do this extraordinary thing, but this is the moment to take a look.
Lethem and a handful of other authors have signed on to an effort challenging Google to guarantee that readers of its virtual library will have as much privacy as they had in traditional libraries. One of the organizers of this effort is the digital civil liberties group called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Legal director Cindy Cohn says a system like Google Books can track your reading very closely.
They know what books you search for, what books you might browse through. They know how long you spend on each page.
In other words, the same kind of information that they know about your web searches. But books should be different, Cohn says. She wants Google to throw away as quickly as possible all the data left behind by book readers. Otherwise, she says, Google Books could become a one-stop shop for anyone trying to dig into your reading habits. Daphne Keller is familiar with those nightmare scenarios.
There's this horrific example of, like, what if your insurance company finds out about the diseases you're researching, which is just not going to happen.
Keller is a lawyer for Google.
It's not going to happen because the regular Google privacy policy says that we don't disclose your personal information except in some really narrow circumstances like emergencies and search warrants.
But a corporate privacy policy isn't enough for Cindy Cohn.
I just think that books and the future of reading is too important to be left to a just trust us version of privacy.
Cohn says now is the time for them to pressure Google because the company is trying to get court approval for a complicated copyright settlement with publishers and authors. The EFF and the ACLU of Northern California are threatening to go to the judge overseeing the settlement and ask that legally binding privacy guarantees be included. Google lawyer Daphne Keller says while the company believes in protecting customers' privacy, it does not think this settlement is the place to make that kind of commitment.
It would be weird to put it in the agreement. You know, it's certainly not the kind of thing that would generally come up in the settlement of a copyright conflict.
But Google needs this settlement. Without it, it may not have the right to post millions of the books that it's already scanned. It's a sensitive moment for the company, and privacy groups know that this is a rare chance to build legally binding reader protections into what could someday become the world's library. Martin Costi, NPR News.
A lot of words have figured in the healthcare debate, but none more controversial than the word government. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been looking at the history of the G word and the changing rhetoric that surrounds it, from the New Deal to the Reagan era to the present.
In sickness and in health, Republicans have always been good at singing from the same hymnal. And right now, they're all turned to the page that's headed Government Takeover. The takeover charge makes supporters of the Democrats' health care plans apoplectic. There's nothing like that in the plans, they say. It's like equating the provision of public toilets with a takeover of the nation's bathrooms. But even so, the supporters would as soon leave the word government out of the conversation, which is why they describe the proposed federally run insurance program as the public option. Public is the word we use when we want to talk about government approvingly by focusing on its beneficiaries, as in public schools, public servants, public lands, and public works. That's how freighted the G word has become. People will readily defend particular government programs, But when you listen to the ambient noise, the radio talk shows, the late-night monologues, the how-many-bureaucrats-does-it-take-to-change-a-light-bulb jokes, it seems to be a truth universally acknowledged that government in the abstract is inefficient, self-serving, intrusive, and generally a terrible idea. The political scientist Samuel Huntington once said that distrust of government is as American as apple pie. But that suspicion waxes and wanes. In other eras, the word government could inspire admiration and even awe. You think back to the 1930s, when millions of kids joined junior G-man clubs, that's G as in government, pledging to become secret operators in law and order patrols, in emulation of J. Edgar Hoover's heroically intrusive federal agents. Or recall the scene toward the end of John Ford's 1940 film of The Grapes of Wrath with Henry Fonda. After their long and harrowing journey from Oklahoma to California, the Jode family finally arrives at a bright, clean camp for migrants run by the Department of Agriculture. And an incredulous Tom Jode talks to the manager.
You aiming to tell me the fellas that are running the camp are just fellas camping here?
That's the way it is.
And you say no cops?
No cop can come in here without a warrant.
I can't hardly believe it. Camp I was in before, they burned it out, the deputies and some of them poorer fellas.
They don't get in here. Sometimes the boys patrol the fences, especially on dance nights.
You got dances too?
We have the best dances in the county every Saturday night.
Who runs this place?
The government.
Why ain't they more like it?
You find out. I can't.
Of course, there were plenty of people back then who weren't quite so grateful for the government's expanded role. But they hedged their objections by granting that government was a useful check on the excesses of the private sector. When Republican presidential candidate Wendell Willkie coined the phrase big government in 1940, it was a play on the words big business. And he conceded that government intervention had been necessary to correct what he called corporate tyranny. And over the next 30 years, Republicans from Taft to Eisenhower to Nixon never warned of the risks of big government without also acknowledging the need to restrain big business as well. That rhetoric shifted abruptly in the 1970s when public confidence in government dropped precipitously. People have blamed that on everything from Vietnam and Watergate to negative campaigning and media sensationalism. By the 1976 election, Ford and Carter were both running against the bloated federal bureaucracy. But it was Ronald Reagan who decisively transformed the language of political debate. Earlier Republicans opposed big government because it was big. Reagan opposed it because it was government. And he drove his views home with jaunty aphorisms. The government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth. The 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Actually, it was the Democrat Ed Muskie who was the first politician to use that line, but Reagan had a way of making these things his own. But Reagan's real contribution was to shrink the cast of characters to a basic opposition between government and the people. Big business was eliminated from the political landscape, absorbed into the market, where everybody was free to shop around for the ripest tomatoes. You could no longer ask the question, whose side is government on? Government simply was the other side. Within a decade, that had become the received picture not just for the Gingrich Republicans, but for the new Democrats, who were trying to neutralize the Republicans' rhetorical advantage, albeit with mixed success. In 1996, Bill Clinton famously proclaimed in his State of the Union speech that the era of big government is over. The next day, the conservative Weekly Standard ran the headline, "We Win." You can hear the echoes of Reagan's voice when opponents of the health care plans raise the specter of government bureaucrats interfering with the sanctity of the doctor-patient relationship, cropping the insurance companies out of the frame. That's no doubt what led President Obama a few weeks ago to start talking about insurance reform rather than health care reform by way of refocusing attention on the insurance companies and the HMOs. Nobody expects Americans to become as enthusiastic about government as they were during the New Deal, and just as well, since that tends to go along with desperate times. But with the revival of populist rhetoric in the bailout era, people may return to talking about government with a resigned acceptance, the way Nelson Rockefeller did almost 50 years ago. Let's face it, he said, big government is here to stay, like big business. This is a big country, after all.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
One person who knows both sides of the healthcare debate is Wendell Potter. He was a top executive at Cigna Healthcare. He was working there the last time a Democratic president tried to massively overhaul healthcare, and that was back in the early 90s. Last year, Wendell Potter became disillusioned with his industry, and he left to become an advocate of healthcare reform. He recently testified in front of Congress. He told senators that the industry works, in his words, to confuse their customers and dump the sick all so they can satisfy their Wall Street investors. Recently, I spoke with Wendell Potter, and I asked him to contrast the approach the healthcare industry used to oppose Clinton-era proposals with the industry's current strategy.
There are a lot of similarities. The big difference is that the industry was a bit more upfront in its intentions and its advertising. There was the famous or infamous Harry and Louise commercials that were paid for and produced by the health insurance industry. They're not doing anything like that right now. But one component then and one component now is PR campaigns that you don't really see. I call their efforts duplicitous because you do see, on the one hand, their charm offensive or things that they want people to believe about them, and they will say what people want them to hear. Behind the scenes, though, that's where the real work is being done. And you see it being played out now through third-party groups and front groups that the industry funds. You're seeing it playing out in terms of the way that some of these town halls are being disrupted. It went on in 1993, 94 as well to kill healthcare reform, and that's really the objective this time around as well.
You're saying the people who are disrupting these town halls are actually being paid for by the insurance companies?
Indirectly. The money that the insurance industry funnels into front groups and other organizations is kind of hard to trace because it usually flows through PR firms and into these organizations that are established for no other purpose except to denounce or demean a certain approach to healthcare reform that happened essentially to try to blunt the effects of the movie Sicko. So this is something that the industry has done many times and has been very successful for the industry many times.
Part of the difference, from what I understand this time around, is that the insurance industry seemed to be behind a large portion of the legislation that's going through Congress right now, with the exception of the public option. They have agreed to go along with this idea that you can't dump people who have pre-existing conditions from coverage, for example. And I'm wondering if you see them as coming a long way, or at least partway towards your position.
Well, those are good things that need to be done, but I question their sincerity because you can look at congressional testimony from 1993 and you can find them saying absolutely exactly the same things. But as soon as the spotlight passes and healthcare, as it has in the past, has failed, they've made no effort to make good on those assurances.
Of course, people on the other side say, well, once you have a government option, you're going to force the private insurance companies out of business because as a government-run entity, you'll be able to undercut them. Once they're out of business, the quality of care will suffer.
No, it's not at all true. In fact, you've got examples that already exist in our economy. You've got the Postal Service competing with UPS and FedEx, and there are other sectors of the economy where there is a public or quasi-public entity that competes with the private sector and quite well, and they work to keep each other honest.
You mentioned the Michael Moore movie, Sicko, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the money the insurance company pours into this debate.
I think there's no doubt that money makes a big difference in money from the insurance industry, and that film did note that. A lot of the insurance money right now is going to very influential Democrats in Congress, Senator Max Baucus in particular, who is very pivotal in the Senate as chair of the Senate Finance Committee. The Blue Dog Democrats are getting a lot of attention from the insurance industry. One thing that has happened over the last several years, particularly during the Bush years, the industry was focusing a lot on the Republican Party, and most of the donations from the political action committees and executives went to Republican candidates, to the point that they essentially have them sewn up. They can expect the Republicans in both the House and the Senate to vote the way they want them to vote on almost every issue. And the focus, knowing that, they have focused a lot of their time and attention and money on the so-called Blue Dog Democrats and others who would be considered moderate to conservative, because they're the ones that they think they can peel away from supporting a public option. That's what's going on. And millions of dollars are being spent to do that. And more than 300 lobbyists representing the health insurance industry are working on Capitol Hill every day.
Wendell Potter used to be a PR executive at Cigna and Humana. He quit and is now with the Center for Media and Democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And for more perspectives on the healthcare debate, you can go to our website, thenewnpr.org.
We go now from the digital library to an older literary tradition, the summer reading list for kids. If you have school-aged children, they may well be working their way through such a list right now. And we wanted to take a few minutes to put together our own list of classics for young adults. To do that, we called Leslie Bloom. She's the author of several books for young readers, most recently Tennyson. Leslie joined us from our bureau in New York. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, I notice when I look at your list that there isn't any book published after 1983. And you include one book that was written in 1924. I guess that means that these must have been books that you read when you were a kid.
I did. And one of the beauties of this list is that parents will love to rediscover these titles. The book that you're referring to, my 1924 book on this list, is The Boxcar Children, which actually was a mini book series by Gertrude Chandler Warner. It's the story of four orphan siblings who run away from their orphanage and create a home for themselves in an abandoned boxcar in the forest. And I think that the idea of just basically setting up shop and running your own show is always enticing. No rules, no baths, no schoolwork, not being told what to do. The environment is enticing because it's unusual, and also because it's totally free, and the children actually themselves become adults.
Now, you put a book on this list by Roald Dahl, who's, of course, very well known for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach and other children's classics. But you picked one that I haven't heard of, The Witches, which you say is scary.
I really, really love The Witches. And, you know, a lot of children's literature is traditionally very scary and very frightening. And but in a tantalizing way. What happens in this book is a 7-year-old boy, orphaned, of course, because all children's book characters always have to be orphaned, goes to live with his grandmother. And it turns out that his grandmother is an expert on witches. And the two of them come across a well-connected organization of witches, which is launching a nefarious plot to destroy children, all the children in the country.
Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, dun. And it turns out that the witches look like ordinary people, which is quite amazing. And the reader is told, quote, "Real witches dress in ordinary clothes and look very much like ordinary women.
Oh,
they
my goodness.
Live in ordinary houses and work in ordinary jobs. That is why they are so hard to catch." And without spoiling the ending, I will say that it has not exactly a fairy tale ending in that everything ends happily. And, you know, life is not about neat, perfect endings. This book does not have one. Kids know the difference. They don't like condescending authors. They like it when people give it to them straight. And Roald Dahl has definitely given them that in this book, albeit in a very whimsical package.
You also picked The Devil's Storybook by Natalie Babbitt. And that was the book on the list that you thought we might hear a little bit from, a reading.
Natalie Babbitt, most people probably know her for her classic Tuck Everlasting, which is a beautiful
right.
book. And the Devil Storybook I don't think was ever hugely popular, I think because it was a little contentious, the idea of writing a collection of short stories about a devil who is sort of a naughty rogue. He's really funny. And hell is not what you would expect. He's not what you would expect. And I just wanted to read you a very short little paragraph from the very first story in the book called Wishes. And it starts, "One day, when things were dull in hell, the devil fished around in his bag of disguises, dressed himself as a fairy godmother, and came up into the world to find someone to bother. He wandered down the first country road he came to, and before long he met a crabby farm wife stumping along with a load of switches on her back." And that's the end of the paragraph. And I love the idea of things being dull in hell. And I like the idea that the devil has nothing better to do but go around and bother people and pester them, dress up as fairy godmothers, that he has a ready array of costumes. I mean, the language of a lot of these classic children's books is absolutely wonderful. And we have to make sure that the books that we love go into the hands of our own children.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Leslie Bloom is the author of several books for young readers. Her most recent book is called Tennyson. It's a Southern Gothic mystery novel. And if you want to look at Leslie Bloom's complete list of books for kids, plus find summer reading recommendations for adults, look at the new NPR.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. The Earth is facing some very big problems: warmer oceans, rising carbon dioxide levels, new pollutants in the air and water, and it's going to take some very smart scientists to figure out what to do. But students in the U.S. aren't exactly flocking to programs that would prepare them to tackle these challenges. So NASA is taking to the skies in hopes of luring students into studying the planet. NPR's John Hamilton went along for a ride.
A great place to study the Earth is from the air.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, open.
These researchers are working in an airborne laboratory, a modified DC-8 flying low over the inland valleys of Central California.
Ready? Close.
Every minute or so, one of them opens a valve that sends a sample of air from outside the plane into a stainless steel canister the size of an overgrown cocktail shaker.
Good. Now you can open up a little bit more to let the flow.
Oh, okay. I don't want it to drop there.
Yeah.
The experiment will measure gases from dairy farms 1,000 feet below us. Cows belch up a lot of methane, and the process used to prepare their feed can raise levels of ozone, another greenhouse gas. Usually, flights like this are reserved for top researchers. But these two scientists are students. Camille Armayes-Noya is 29 and dressed in the flight's unofficial uniform, jeans and a T-shirt. She's been in pretty much constant motion since the seatbelt sign went off. When Camille's not checking the weather on a laptop, she's running the air sampler. It helps that she's thin enough to squeeze into the small gap between the equipment and a row of seats. Camille has a background in chemistry, and she's about to finish a master's in environmental management at the Metropolitan University in Puerto Rico.
Right now I am applying for a PhD in oceanography, and actually chemical oceanography. So I can, you know, apply what I study, but I also can experience new things, especially the ocean, which is my passion.
Daniel Tachik grew up in Georgia and has a buzz cut that falls somewhere between edgy and aerospace engineer. He's 23, but Daniel's resume already includes stuff like studying carbon in the salt marshes of Skidaway Island. This fall, Daniel will start a PhD in civil and environmental engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. But he says he's been intrigued by the Earth's atmosphere since he was a kid.
You know, my family would be down in the basement during a tornado warning, and I'd be running upstairs trying to, you know, look out the window, try to see what I can see, and, you know, parents yelling at me.
Daniel and Camille are exactly the kind of people NASA hopes to attract to study our planet. They are highly motivated, they are fascinated by the Earth, and troubled by its environmental problems. Also, since high school, they've been taking all the right courses.
calculus, calculus 2, linear algebra, differential equations, multivariable calculus, electromagnetics, physics 1.
Analytical chemistry, analytical chemistry 2, physical chemistry, organic.
High academic achievement helped them get on today's flight. The flight is part of NASA's Student Airborne Research Program, an experimental 6-week session designed to get young people excited about Earth science. The 29 students in this session have already heard lectures from people including Sherwood Rowland. He won the 1995 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for figuring out that CFCs were damaging the Earth's ozone layer. For the past few days, the students have been at NASA's Dryden Aircraft Operations Facility in Palmdale, California. Dr. George Seilstadt from the University of North Dakota worked with NASA to set up the program, including the in-flight experiments.
We're doing real science. This isn't a little practice lab session where you get to see how things would be done someday if you became a scientist. You're going to be a scientist, and we're going to come out with some real results. And the results all impact society.
In addition to gases from dairy farms, the students are looking at water consumption by cotton and almond plants. That's a big deal in Central California, where those crops have been hurt by years of drought. And the students are using an image sensor to study unusual algae growth in Monterey Bay. So-called algal blooms can kill fish and make shellfish poisonous. The blooms are more common in water contaminated by sewage and agricultural fertilizers.
So in every case, it's beautiful science, but this will help people if we come up with some solutions.
Seilstadt says those solutions are likely to come from a new generation of Earth scientists.
My generation has done the best science it could, and I think we've learned a lot about the Earth, but you're always looking for new ideas.
And new ideas, he says, often come from people who don't necessarily look like the older generation or sound like them.
Cinco, cuatro, tres, uno, abre.
A couple of hours into the flight, the students have collected most of the critical air samples, and the DC-8 is about to turn toward Monterey Bay for the algae experiment. There's been a lot of concern about a fog bank hovering over the bay. Fog makes it almost impossible to detect algae blooms. But at the moment, forecasters are predicting clear skies. The algae team, which includes Daniel and Camille, is pretty pumped up. Then, the pilot hears a couple of small clunks.
Did you hear the excitement?
And the students get some bad news.
We hit a small bird in engine number 2, and there's a little hole, but it's no emergency or anything. We're going to do the cotton field run one more time and basically head back. So we will not be flying over Monterey Bay, which means we have no data from this flight.
You can tell you're on a plane full of scientists when the biggest concern about a hole in the plane is whether it will screw up someone's experiment.
It sucks. Because the clouds... Here, let's take a look at this little image right here. The clouds have finally opened up. Everything looks awesome. We would have had so much data, but now we got nothing. That is exactly the real world of science. Not everything works all the time, and, you know, you just got to keep trying sometimes. I don't know.
By the time we're back on the ground, though, everyone is sounding a lot more optimistic.
Big round of applause for the flight crew and the support crew.
Next, the students will go back to the University of California, Irvine, to analyze their data.
Tomorrow morning, checkout is at 11 a.m. sharp, so...
The air sampling team will quantify the methanol and ethanol and ethane coming from dairy farms. This will help show the farm's contribution to global warming and perhaps whether the cows there should go on a low-emissions diet. Another group will figure out which parts of the cotton fields and almond orchards need more irrigation and which could do with a bit less. And Daniel and Camille will try to salvage their algae experiment using data from a flight 2 days earlier.
This group of techs are going to help us process the data. And then next week it starts the data analysis and all the hard work.
There are already hints that this hard work will pay off. A first look at the data suggests that an algae bloom is beginning to form in one corner of Monterey Bay. John Hamilton, NPR News.
To see pictures of the students at work aboard the aircraft and learn more about that program, go to the new NPR.org. This is NPR News.
If you've been on the highway lately, you may have noticed there are fewer big trucks on the roads this summer. Consumers are buying less, so everybody involved in the vast system that moves products from farms and factories to stores is feeling the difference. We have a report this morning from Frank Morris of member station KCUR in Kansas City.
First thing in the morning, at the big truck stop in Oak Grove, Missouri, the restaurant is not quite half full with truckers like Dee Jones, killing time, making calls, and looking for work.
Good morning, Jeff. Oh, I'm just sitting here in Oak Grove. Well, I'm waiting for you to give me some good news.
Not much of that lately. For every 5 truckloads moving last year, there are now only 4. That's left Jones parked here in his black cap, red shirt, and boots.
If there's somebody that's come up with a hot load here, well, I'm gone. If there's not, I'm here for another day. Freight's down, way down.
Jones finds work where he can. His last load before today was hauling shell casings for military bullets. He also hauls hazardous farm chemicals. Shipments of construction materials and heavy equipment are off the most, fresh and frozen food the least. But even Mac Shepard, a big guy at the counter who hauls meat and produce in a refrigerated truck, is idling here today.
Well, I've been doing this for 32 years, so I'm kind of, it kind of comes and goes. But here lately, I ain't never seen it this bad.
And these days when Dee Jones fires up his diesel, it's likely as not to be a long haul empty, just to make a pickup.
That is a no-no. That burns your profit up in a hurry.
To make matters worse, shipping rates have collapsed along with demand. Bob Costello, an economist at American Trucking Associations, says the slowdown's hitting independents and big trucking firms alike.
Trucking companies are just shrinking. They're just getting rid of trucks. You don't need them.
And trucking isn't the only part of the freight chain suddenly way too big for this economy.
Yeah, there's a lot of empty warehouses. In Kansas City alone, there is millions of empty square feet of warehouse space.
Doug Farrell is vice president of Scarborough International, a warehouse and customs broker in Kansas City.
The range of stuff that comes through this warehouse is very broad, anywhere from animal pharmaceuticals to plastic material for Walmart cups, plates, things like that, to tractor engines, diesel engines.
As a machine shrink-wraps a spinning pallet of plastic Christmas knickknacks, Farrell says the warehouse business overall has dropped about 20%, although they have noticed a recent uptick as some of the seasonal business starts to come in. A few miles away, Keith Milburn, the owner of Creative Fulfillment, another warehouse, says they've also seen a couple of bright spots. These light-up mirrors they're unpacking, for instance.
They're what I would describe as vanity mirrors or ladies' makeup mirrors from China. We have one container came in last Thursday, got another one today, and we've got another one within the next couple of weeks.
High-end wool socks appear to be selling well, too, as are $500 leather-bound Beatles trivia books. But economist Bob Costello cautions that overall, freight shippers are in for more pain as the logistics system, developed to serve a nation of wealthy free spenders, continues to shrink. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.